Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome to another edition of On the Continent, your one-stop shop for all things to do with European football. My name's Dotun Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Miguel Delaney.
On today's show, a lot to talk about. The business side of the Champions League has just begun, and it's a case of the last of the summer wine to a certain extent. Also, the most hated club in Germany are through. And was this the best year ever to not qualify for the Champions League? But sadly, we begin the show with another death of an icon of football, certainly of the 1982 World Cup in Spain, Paolo Rossi. I heard the news last night myself, and it really sent shivers down me because it was a player from my generation of World Cup fanaticism in those days. That just went way too early in his life. Miguel, as we're talking about the 1982 World Cup in Spain, I know you're a little bit too young to perhaps remember Paolo Rossi, but I imagine what he did at that World Cup is still quite legendary and talked about.
Well, even in some of the discussion I saw just this morning, and especially in light of the other great World Cup legend or football legend that died 2 weeks ago, Diego Maradona. Well, I mean, just after Maradona, there's the argument that Rossi dominated the World Cup to a greater degree than any other player. And certainly, I can't think of any other striker in history that scored so many decisive goals. I mean, it is actually incredible that Rossi got, he was a top scorer in that, with that classic kind of World Cup number of six to win the Golden Boot. And all of his goals came in decisive games from the end. I mean, it's that in itself is sensational. I mean, if we're talking about clutch finishers, there's the ultimate example. And whatever about the kind of the coldness of the numbers, I know with that 82 World Cup, everyone thinks of Tardelli celebration, but Rossi had one of those of his own when he scored against Italy, just that raw emotion. And yeah, truly distinctive.
When he scored against Brazil. Yeah, and I suppose the game against Brazil, even though it would be overshadowed by the final, where Rossi kicked off Italy's goal-scoring spree with his own great header, by the way. But the game against Brazil, where he gets a hat-trick, that was phenomenal, Andy.
That's the one, because by the time that you get to the final and he scores against West Germany, the whole world that's not West German wants him to do it because of what happened in the semi-final between Battiston and Schumacher. So this is the thing that he talked about it in a documentary a while back as being his personal redemption, because of course he'd just come back from a match-fixing ban, a year of which was shaved off, so he was able to be picked by Enzo Bertzot and make the Italy squad to play in the finals, which a lot of people thought was a really bad idea because he hadn't played football for 2 years. And so he comes back in for the group for the first group stage, looks as if he hasn't played football for 2 years. And then against Brazil, you know, when we talk about retro football, I think we often like get lost a bit in the romanticism of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But this isn't what Paolo Rossi's about at all. As you say, the numbers kind of say it to an extent. He's such a clinical finisher. And the way that he destroyed that Brazil side in that last game of the second round, Robin, that people were absolutely in love with. If you listen to the commentary of that, if you go back and watch the BBC broadcast of that, John Motson is drooling over Brazil. He's absolutely drooling over Brazil. And there's the bit, the second goal, you know, you mentioned the header, Dotton, which is a great header. They're all great finishes. But the second one, the Toninho Cerezo mistake, where he passes it straight to Rossi and Rossi just arrows in and exercises it into the corner. And I'm sure there are still a lot of people who watch that go, why did that have to happen to Cerezo?
Yeah.
And I know he went on and just had a terrific career in Italy. You know, he did great with Roma. He won the league with Sampdoria. You know, that must have lived in his head forever.
Isn't that quite a beautiful thing for a legacy to have? I mean, whatever about the numbers of finishing World Cup winner and Golden Boot winner, he is basically, I mean, when you think of a vintage World Cup match, the kind of the drama of it, the theatre, the emotion.
That's the high watermark.
Brazil Italy is the high watermark. And Rossi is probably the player most singularly identified with that game. And even beyond that kind of what he represents, that emotional sense, he's just looking at his broader numbers as well. I mean, this is a striker who got 103 goals in 251 games in Serie A, in Italian football in total. And in an era when Italy itself was kind of they're the high priests of defensive football, where goals were hard got in that era, really hard got. Like a lot of top scorers in Serie A at that point were kind of around 15 goals. That is a really remarkable record and speaks to the type of striker he was.
I can't think of anybody else who has got a hat-trick against Brazil in a World Cup. Having said that, that second goal that Andy talks about, I think people forget this. He was very alert.
Yeah.
You know, even though it might have been a mistake on the Brazilian side, he was really alert. He was the fastest person on the pitch to react to that, certainly. And I wonder whether, and you mentioned Maradona, who died a couple of weeks ago, and I think for all the right reasons, the world remembers the 1986 World Cup with Maradona. But does that overshadow what the achievements of Paolo Rossi in 1982, Miguel?
I'm not sure overshadow, because Rossi's just remembered in his own right. It's just, I suppose, when we talk about players that are associated with a single World Cup and dominated a single World Cup, it is Maradona's performance that really stands above. But I don't think, in fact, it actually speaks to Rossi's legacy that the next one on that list is arguably him. To be put on that pedestal with Maradona is quite a testament.
So one end of the Champions League is over, the group stage, and it didn't end without some drama. And Andy, I know you want to talk about the two Ballon d'Or winners who were pitched up against each other, and for years and years and years have been matched against each other. Who's the best player in the world, Cristiano Ronaldo or Lionel Messi? So they meet in the final game between Barcelona and Juventus, and it was a game of two old-timers, in a way.
It was. It's interesting that we feel like we naturally want to frame it around the two best players in the world. If there's one thing we learned from the Champions League this week, it's probably that neither of them is the best player in the world. But to frame it like this, I mean, you know, they did and still do, to an extent, inform this whole generation of football supporters. And, you know, they've taken it to a new standard. But it's funny because hearing lots of people talking about this last group game, which of course it mattered to an extent who would finish top of the group, and you know, it looked like a hard call for Juventus to get the top spot. They did manage it, but of course there's a lot of people going, oh, it could be the last time they ever play each other. And I'm thinking, who's going somewhere?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but I don't know, maybe people are starting to feel, particularly with the fact that Ronaldo's been a long way from winning the Champions League for a long time. So's Messi, and Messi has been in a really unenviable situation at Barcelona. For the first time, we're really getting a sense of their footballing mortality.
Yeah.
And not completely because of what they're doing.
No, exactly, yeah. Well, although I do remember thinking, but just before the summer, actually, just before the big kind of the Champions League blitz in Lisbon or whatever you want to call it, I remember thinking at that point, because it had started to grow a little bit, whether, I mean, I remember I wrote a piece in the Time over whether Messi should now finally make the decision to leave Barcelona, which turned out he was actually considering. But I remember thinking, I'm getting quite sad about it. We're going to have to come to a time very soon when Messi probably isn't the best player in the world, is close to his retirement, and is just his powers have waned. And a little bit like bankruptcy, as Hemingway said, that kind of has happened gradually and now suddenly, where we are seeing a situation where, and of course, you can't divorce this from what Barcelona are at the moment, but even Messi is just not impacting games the way he has for like what is an incredible 15 years. And I mean, you could say similar of Ronaldo. I mean, Ronaldo, it's a little bit different because of his position and because he's been more more singularly defined by goals than Messi. But even, I mean, like I was just talking to people during the week because I've been doing something on the Paul Pogba situation, which is connected to Ronaldo and the fact that Juventus might actually be interested in a swap. I mean, it's not impossible. But connected to all that was the view that ultimately Juventus are trying to install this collective idea of football. They initially tried to do Sarri, now they're trying to do through Pirlo. But that is actually almost impossible to do while Ronaldo was there, because the way he plays, it just doesn't really fit into that collective approach. Now, obviously, that was not a problem at all when he was at his absolute maximum. But now it means even more than ever, the Juventus team has to play to a certain way. Then there's that kind of dilemma where a manager will in the long term want to instill a more collective system. But while they're doing that, it's such an easy solution, well, get the ball to Chris. But then the problem is, it becomes difficult to wean players off that. And you're kind of, so this is true in the way they play, I think, where I think both Messi and Ronaldo are almost inhibiting to a degree what their teams can do tactically. But they're also inhibiting what they can do in the long term. And this is becoming a real issue for both teams, because I think both players, they have such a gravitational weight. So that's in how they play, but also on the finances of their clubs, where because of who they are, they consume so much money. And both of those clubs are at points now where they badly need overhauls. They need reboots, really.
Exactly. It's like the Lakers couldn't rebuild while Kobe was still there.
Yeah.
Like way past the point that he
Lakers,
was past his best.
Do you want to explain that it's a different discipline?
Yeah, we can do that. I mean, basically, I'm thinking maybe not Barcelona fans, because he might not be there next season, but Juventus fans are certainly going to feel that in the way going forward, I think, unless that they managed to shift that contract. I mean, interestingly, you talked about the possibility of a Ronaldo Pogba swap, and we'll come back to the game in a minute. But I think it's interesting because, of course, there's been talk that hasn't gone away for a long time now. I'd say over the last year, and particularly post Corona, the fact that should Juventus consider moving on Cristiano Ronaldo and that massive contract because they can't possibly rebuild while he's there. I think they should if there's a possibility. But if we're to use the NBA analogy again, it's almost untradeable. And certainly, I think it's changed in the last even week and a half, because, of course, after the Manchester United game with Paris Saint-Germain, Old Trafford, one of the most notable parts of that was Neymar coming out afterwards and going, come what may, I want to play in the same club as Messi next season. Now, Ronald Koeman, I don't know whether he's just stirring or being completely disingenuous, but he said in the pre-match press conference before they played Cardiff at the weekend, which was David Cartlidge's game of the week last week, what a brilliant game it was. And Koeman said, well, we're interested in all good players here at Barcelona. It's like, well, even if Messi wanted to stay, you probably couldn't afford to keep him. So how's that possibly going to happen? Now, what that means to me is a lot of people have said, Pep, Messi, Manchester City. But Neymar, as we've said before, is basically saying, or as I've said before, is basically saying off the back of that, bring me my guy. If you want to keep me here in Paris, bring me my guy. So that shuts down the possibility of Ronaldo going there, obviously.
And on that, and I know this is a discussion we'll get into in the second part about the state of the leagues, but Paris Saint-Germain are also one of the few clubs, because of their ownership, that have relatively stable finances after the effect of COVID, which is playing havoc with the current domestic seasons. So it's why I think in these situations, some are like Pogba's the same, and Ronaldo's in that area, as you said. many are looking to Paris Saint-Germain as a potential way out. And it's interesting how the football world has flipped in that sense, especially from 3 years ago, where, you know, to leave Barcelona or Real Madrid or maybe one of the Italian giants for Paris Saint-Germain would have been seen as, like with Neymar, that was a strange decision. Whereas now, I mean, things have tilted.
They have, but it's even tighter for them because they're getting to a point, and it's going to define how Leonardo's term as sporting director is because in 2022, Neymar and Mbappe are out of contract. Now, that's why Neymar can make these kind of demands, because he's saying, if you want to keep me, they're in the middle of negotiation. And you re-up those two. How much money have you got left?
I know,
Is it really about money? I wonder, because I want to go back to an existential point that Miguel made a moment or two ago, which is when you have players on that level of greatest football in the world, even though that's in the past, it's hard, it's difficult to function around them because the entire team is constrained to a certain extent.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
And vice versa as well, because obviously if they go somewhere else, if somebody else snaps them up, even though their team hasn't been constrained previously, now that they're there, you get to a certain level. It's like having a great movie star, I don't know who's the greatest movie star, Tom Hanks or something, coming onto Coronation Street.
It has to be about him.
Yeah. You know, of course
it's not about,
it has to
it's not about everyone else.
I just wonder whether that is, to an extent, a poison chalice when you go through these...
100%. 100%.
I interviewed Quique Setién 2 years ago, and it's interesting, given the subject of that interview, what happened after that. When he was talking about Messi, he said, the one player you kind of allow your tactical system to be disrupted for is Messi.
Was this before he was Barcelona coach?
So this is when he was at Betis. This is the summer of 2018.
Okay.
And he said, the one player you allow your tactical system to be disrupted for is Messi, because he can do anything. And I think about that in general, and even players like Messi and Ronaldo, or if you want to go to Neymar as well, I suppose you indulge anything with these players as long as they're at their best, because they're so devastatingly good. But, I mean, it's... There's like almost a, there has to be a coldness to it. It really does come to the point then suddenly where they drop below them being worth all the money and all the hassle. I mean, hassle is the wrong word, but all the indulgence and all the compromise you need elsewhere. And it does feel like we're at that tipping point with the two greats of the last era.
I guess my question would be, and not entirely based on this game, because obviously it was a very bad night for Barcelona, a very good one for Juventus and Pirlo. I mean, I saw Guillaume Balaguer actually suggesting it was Messi's best game of the season because he got a number of shots on target. Yeah. I guess the thing is...
That's dropping the standard, isn't it?
I don't want to just define it by this game, because I don't think that's fair to either of them. But... You know, I wonder, A, how much Messi can do in this current Barcelona side, given the help that he's got or that he hasn't got. And B, just as a more general point, is Ronaldo's game weathering a bit better? Because as Miguel said earlier, he's just about the goals.
Yeah.
And anything else is strictly a bonus.
Well, because I think the way Messi plays as well, there is that expectation that he's going to sit in a certain area and exert force over that whole area. Mm. And they get the ball and run with it. So it's almost more integrated into the team, where Ronaldo is much more of a fixed point. And if you get the ball to that fixed point, he'll do damage.
So Messi's game is more about running.
Yeah, no, I do wonder though if, I mean, say we get to a certain point where Messi kind of just, I mean, it was actually a little bit this in the 2014 World Cup when Messi wasn't at his physical peak, but if you sat him kind of in midfield and he started spraying balls around, I mean, he'd be exceptional at it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and there's an interesting, I do think there's potentially more evolution to come from Messi, but right now it feels like Ronaldo's game can be more effective just because it's there's more of a simplicity to it.
I know you wanted to talk briefly about the game, Andy. Jammy penalty to start off with. Let's just begin very good. Well, it was, wasn't it? Come on now.
But that's the brilliant thing about Ronaldo. He's so pitiless. He's absolutely pitiless.
He's like, give me the ball. Just give me the ball and put it on the penalty spot.
I don't care if we're both qualified. I don't care if this is not quite a dead rubber of a group match, but heading in that direction. I will celebrate in my customary style after smashing it.
And we can hear
it
now. We don't just see the customary style
that's absolutely right. That was one of my favourite things from the Champions League this week, that we've talked about, you know, the sound of the ball hitting the crossbar that you don't get when fans are in the stadium, or a ball when, what was it, against Harry Winks scored, wasn't it, against Ludogorets ages miles out, and it sort of rattled the back of the net. But Cristiano saying the "Sii!" Yeah, that was pretty good, wasn't it?
Chiama in avanti Cabrini. Rossi, gol! Rossi! Italia in vantaggio, Rossi! Quinto minuto, Italia 1, Brasile 0. Ha segnato Rossi.
Let's talk about another, I suppose, team in the Champions League that seem to be doing really well, but nobody likes them, but they don't seem to care, Miguel. RB Leipzig?
I wrote a piece on this. I did a big one, really, in August when they were ahead of the Champions League semi-final, and it was, I suppose, that interesting clash, given it was basically a state in Qatar against a sports drink brand in Red Bull. And there's almost two sides to Leipzig, because obviously we've had the discussion plenty about how their whole model goes against what it is to be a football club, and especially the social dimension of a football club in Germany, especially because they almost, it was just kind of bought out another club and kind of imposed in an area. But the kind of the other side of that, an almost contradiction and complication, is that because they did that and could start a club from scratch, okay, they're absolutely not a model club from a social perspective in Germany, but from the point of view of what you can be as a football club, they're completely a model, and they're possibly, I mean, if you're looking to restructure your club, Leipzig are the sort of idea you should be viewing and should be taking on. And because, I mean, in that sense, they're almost perfectly run. Now, again, it was a slight irony on Tuesday night in that I think it's so massively to their advantage the way they sign players. So they have a general policy. They don't sign players under third contract. It's very rare you'd ever see them sign a player over 25. And it creates a very young team that can be moulded into this very specific, dynamic and kind of sophisticated approach of football, where there's suddenly players coming from all angles. I mean, the classic example of that being the score of the first goal on Tuesday, Angelino. In fact, he's their top scorer this season. But I do wonder then whether that lack of experience has an effect in some big games, and certainly in some crunch moments, as it did on Tuesday.
It did in the semi, didn't it?
Yeah,
it definitely did in the semi in Lisbon. But I think the interesting thing is, when you look at where they are now, they've got more experienced players than they ever had.
Yeah.
I think simply because, and you're right, it's all about player development. And in terms of the way they do that, there's none better, really. But now they've got sort of experienced players almost by default. They're longest serving players. So not just Gulashi, who really stood up in that game.
Yeah.
Forsberg, who's 29 now, who's brilliant in the first half. Kevin Campbell, who was the only one who could really stand up to Scott McTominay in midfield, who's got technique, but he's happy to get stuck in as well. He's 30. And I think because the conditions are so good there, I mean, I think you look at the training facilities, the stadium. Leipzig is actually a very beautiful city as well. You're very nicely paid. And there's the feeling that you're going somewhere. I mean, I always wondered if it would be the point when Nagelsmann gets to... I wondered if he thought that after the semi-final. Like, can we go any further from this?
And
he's such an ambitious guy. I don't think it's unrealistic to say there's a point where he's like, well, if I've done all I can here, I'm out. He will come to that point for him at some point. But the fact that they've sort of not bought experienced players, because they're never going to do that, but like inherited and developed experienced players.
So, funny enough, actually, just on Nagelsmann and his own ambition, I was talking to a former recent Premier League coach last week. And I suppose this almost points to a little bit of the maybe the kind of pettiness and little jealousies among managers.
Oh, we definitely want to hear this.
Yeah, but we were talking about kind of, you know, management styles and potential options that clubs will go for, and like I was talking about, maybe Nagelsmann to Manchester United eventually or something like that. And Nagelsmann has to prove he can do it at a club like Everton first. But they made the point that basically there's a big difference between coming from a place like from Leipzig where, as we've just been talking about, you have this group of very young players. And there's actually been a little bit in the way Louis van Gaal has worked. And I mean, you could argue maybe Pochettino, that they work best. And he argued that this was the test for
moulding young minds.
Yeah, moulding young minds who are very malleable, who have no kind of prior experience or no career where they've been introduced to all these different options. And by the time they get to 28, and they've got this kind of ultra demanding mode of football, they're kind of, well, hang on, I don't fancy this.
Especially in the Premier League, yeah. I think. And funnily enough, if you look at Dennis Bergkamp's autobiography, for example, the point that it's interesting to hear you mentioning Van Gaal, the point that he falls out with Van Gaal, he goes, well, you don't like me anymore because I answer back now, because I've got my own opinion now.
Yeah. You know, remember David Moyes proved that he could do it at Everton, but then what happened to him when he went to Man United? So hold that thought. You know, the problem with RB Leipzig, and I'm going back to your article in The Independent, Mikel, in August, is it sounds to me like a club without soul, without a soul. And, okay, a soul is perhaps, you know, some kind of metaphoric imagery within football, but it's an important one nevertheless.
And it's something that we're thinking about a lot at the moment, yeah, with the importance of fans, isn't it?
Oh yeah. It's something that you know about with regards to MK Dons as well.
There's a club of soul.
Sorry to bring that up. But nevertheless, I can understand why a manager might think, oh, I've gone as far as I can with this club, because it's a club that you don't have an emotional attachment to if you're being brought in from outside. It's not like Jurgen Klopp. I can't imagine Jurgen Klopp saying, oh, I've gone as far as I can with Liverpool. He's bought into the soul of the club, yeah, as fans do, and as some players, not all players, do as well, when they sort of get the trajectory of the club as such. RB Leipzig doesn't have that, and I wonder whether it matters anymore in football. If you're saying this is a model for the future, then we're talking about clubs where the soul connection doesn't have to be there.
I would say model only from the perspective of how you run your football department, not in terms of kind of what they are as a club. Beyond the kind of the social perspective of Leipzig, it does go beyond that, because obviously one of the big arguments is how the kind of Red Bull have circumvented the kind of membership rules in Germany to get around all this.
Yeah.
And that is a bigger issue. But I was thinking there as you said that. I mean, obviously, like with Klopp, say, leaving Liverpool, or when he left Dortmund, it's hard not to think there would have been, compared to, say, with Nagelsmann's potential decision, that it's much more difficult to leave a club where there is this fanatical support, where you go out every week and you're in front of this wall, and that there is, like, that will make it more difficult. And I mean, with Leipzig at the moment, it is a bit more of a sterile surrounding every game. Obviously, right now with no fans, but in general, I mean, when fans are there, because and obviously they've tried to encourage a kind of a family atmosphere and all that. It's not quite the same thing, but in the longer term, I mean, The truth is, when you get into ideas of kind of what a club is, in 40, 50 years' time, because it is a question of time and a moment in time, in 40, 50 years' time, and when they have that kind of 5 decades of tradition and being based in the community,
yeah,
that probably won't matter as much. I mean, if you look at the foundation or something, look at the foundation of Liverpool. Basically, what? It was after Everton left Anfield. Chelsea were similar, a team was needed to play in Stamford Bridge.
Yeah, and look at Paris Saint-Germain. They've only been there since 1970. Yeah. And, you know, really they built that through the European nights in the 90s,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah,
before
yeah.
we even get to the current lot.
I should just add, I'm absolutely not dismissing the debates about what Leipzig are. In fact, I agree with those debates. But the point is more that these things do change over time, and new traditions get developed.
They do, and I think it's interesting to think how, for example, I think the image of Leipzig within Germany and the image of Leipzig outside Germany is quite different. I mean, a lot of people outside Germany just look at it in football terms. Like, you look at Borussia Mönchengladbach, who've qualified for the last 16 of the Champions League. Of course, there was that great scene of them on the pitch Real Madrid last night, all huddled around the phone watching the end of the Inter game to see if they were going to go through, and then celebrating. that is something that has been built up super organically. Yeah. You know, from nearly being relegated, 8-9 years ago, sticking with the sporting director, and I think Archie Rintert of ESPN did an interview with Max Eberl, the sporting director, and he said if they'd have got relegated that season, I would have been fired.
Yeah.
And that sort of sliding doors moment, but they've built it up so gradually since, with a similarly sensible recruitment program, but with far less resources. And the group that Mönchengladbach have come out of, I mean, you look, four German clubs going through to the last 16.
Actually, I mean, if someone ever wanted to pick, say, their Bundesliga club in that way, Gladbach almost they have it great from two sides, in that they're this really enticing underdog story, given they've built themselves up organically again from as you said, but also they've got that real historic tradition as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see which of those groups, the ones with soul, and the one without soul, makes the furthest progress. Yeah. Obviously, it's looking at the moment as if it'll be business as usual in terms of who wins the Champions League.
Well,
it's looking like that, isn't it?
I think it's quite... Oh, well, I think Bayern are still a level above. Yeah. Liverpool look very strong lately as well.
Well, I should correct myself. I should say Bayern, the German team, most likely succeed out of all of those.
I think both Bayern and Liverpool, who I guess would be the other favourites if we're looking at the whole competition, Dotton.
Yeah.
They're both stretched at the moment. And I think it shows that you can't take anything for granted in this Champions League. I wouldn't be surprised, and we've seen it before, like, often you don't get the best team winning it, but often you also get teams who struggled a little bit in the group. I'm not saying Gladbach are going to win it, but teams who struggled a little bit in the group, sort of going above and beyond and gaining momentum in the knockout stages.
Rossi, è ancora l'Italia in vantaggio. Errore di Junior, prontamente sfruttato da Rossi.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Join us for a very Clash of the Titles Christmas, because we're doing what every family does at this time of year. Arguing about which film is better. We've proof this pod is good for your Elf, as Elf takes on Santa Claus the Movie.
With Santa Claus the Movie, for years, I couldn't walk past a slice of ham. Reaching for it like a grubby
street urchin.
Yeah, swear to God.
We're doing that festive thing of overindulging in sweet stuff. It's The Holiday versus Love Actually.
I've never seen women apologise so much for being women as in The Holiday.
And yes, they are Christmas movies. We've got Die Hard versus Lethal Weapon.
I'm so bored of that question, so let's flip it. Is Christmas a Die Hard movie?
That's Clash of the Titles this December. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Clash of the Titles is a Stakhanov production.
Merry Christmas!
It is an exciting time, though, when the group stages of the Champions League is over and the business end of it, as I would like to say, begins. A really exciting time. Arguably, though, Andy, this year of all years is perhaps the year that you might not want to be in the Champions League because of other commitments.
Or in Europe at all. And it's quite interesting. I think if you look at some of the teams that are doing really well domestically, and you know, you've got Lyon, who are going to Paris Saint-Germain this weekend, the first time they haven't qualified for Europe in 24 years. Obviously, from one perspective, not qualifying for Europe in a year like this when everyone's losing money is potentially disastrous because it's another revenue stream shut off. But in terms of watching, and I'm not just talking about the results, but the performances, they've been one of the better teams to watch, I think, from the top European leagues this season, because they just look so fresh compared to other teams, like playing once a week. Now, they can't sustain this for more than one season from from a financial perspective, from the perspective of, despite the fact they've sold a lot of the chaff from around the squad, they've still got a bigger squad than you would expect for a non-European team. I mean, you know, you look at Moussa Dembélé, he's been linked with moves to Chelsea and Manchester United. He's not been in the 11 for most of this season so far. So it shows what intense competition there is. And of course, they've got rid of the Coupe de la Ligue, the French Cup at the end of the French League Cup at the end of last season. It looks like the Coupe de France might not actually happen as well, that logistically it's not possible to make it happen. Of course, it's not just mainland teams that compete. So it might be tricky. And obviously, the amateur teams aren't playing at the moment. So there's been a delayed start to it. It would normally be well underway with, just like in England, the top flight teams joining in January. So A, they're going to retain that freshness, but B, there could be some quite annoyed players, some expensive players, some players with, you know, standing who aren't going to get to play. But I think you look at them, you look at Monaco, who've had some good results, including a victory over Paris Saint-Germain. You look at Fenerbahce to a certain extent, Sporting, who are top of the league in Portugal. And, you know, they've got nowhere near the financial advantages of Porto, who did a brilliant job to get into the last 16 of the Champions League. Five clean sheets in a row after what happened at Manchester City, where they had, what, I guess, 30, 40 bad minutes there. And Benfica, who are going to aim to go quite far in the Europa League. But the fact that Sporting got knocked out in the qualifiers for the Europa League, it has given their they've got the most precious resource in this environment, which is time.
Yeah.
You've got a relatively new coach in Ruben Amorim, and he gets to work with the players. Like, which one of these teams, if we're coming outside these guys, if we're looking at the teams that are in the Champions League particularly, I mean, they haven't got time to do anything, really. They're able to kind of warm down, and that's pretty much it. They can't even train properly.
And that is why, I mean, all these situations you're talking about, they feed into something bigger here. And it's why I think this is an absolutely crucial season for the future competitive balance of football, especially because they're ongoing. I mean, I was on a briefing yesterday there with the European leagues where there's an ongoing discussion about this, about, say, what's going to happen post 2024 with the kind of changes of the Champions League, and crucial with those changes, the amount of solidarity money that goes from UEFA to clubs not competing in Europe, because the fear is the gap is getting too big. And that's why I think this season is so key to this, because what's happened in the last few years of European football, basically, obviously, the super clubs, and this is absolute fact, this is a true statistic, the super clubs are growing financially at a much faster size than everyone else in all their leagues. And it's obviously created this concentration of talent and resources at a certain group of clubs. Now, because of the way the calendar's gone over the past few years, obviously the super clubs have worked around that, and we've seen situations where when they get it right and they have a manager they want and the setup they want, they have the time to absolutely maximise their resources and accumulate all these super coaches as well. So as we've seen with City for those 2 years between 17-19, with Liverpool for the last 2 years, with Bayern, with even Barcelona before things got really bad, they're capable of these kind of 90 to 100 point seasons. And part of that, of course, is because you say there's a training time, especially I think with Bayern and with Liverpool and Man City, or basically any club that coaches like Guardiola or Klopp are going to be at. They're able to kind of impose and really make work the most sophisticated forms of football. Now, COVID has disrupted that, obviously. And one way is the calendar, in that it's crunched it. So as Andy says there, a lot of the more wealthy teams, they don't have the time to really maximise their resource in the same way, because they're going from game to game to game. And the second part of that is that COVID has completely disrupted football's financial market. And as we've discussed with some of the bigger clubs in the last section, so Barcelona are close to a financial crisis. Juventus are close to a financial crisis. Madrid are close to a financial crisis. Paris Saint-Germain, not to the same degree, but equally they've been affected by market forces as well. And a lot of these clubs, basically, they need overhauls and can't do it because of the current situation. I mean, if you look at, and actually Paris Saint-Germain suffered from this problem as well, where suddenly these clubs, because of the last few years, they have these squads stacked with players on massive contracts that they can shift, so they haven't been able to refresh in the same way. And what this whole situation has done, and this is happening right across Europe, is create this opening for these other clubs. Andy just pointed it there, the amount, and you can even go to Spain, Atletico Madrid, all right, they are close to a super club, but they're a level down from Barca and Madrid in general. But it's why I think this season is so interesting and so crucial to the medium term future of football, because if some of these clubs can't win, some of these lesser clubs, lesser financial, I should say, if they can't win a title this season, when is it going to happen?
I suppose the other half of that question, though, is when we see the moments where the super clubs are bettered, and you know, you can think of Leicester winning the title here, or actually, if you go back to
that in a season though, where the other bigger clubs were concentrating on Europe?
Well, I think the point is that they all fell to bits in that season. It didn't just take Leicester being consistent; it took every other big club, Chelsea, Arsenal, United, etc., having a nightmare. And I think you look at that, and the way super clubs react is always with prejudice.
Exactly.
And I think if you go back and, like, say, go back to the Bundesliga at the start of the last decade, so you look at Dortmund winning the league in 2011 and 2012, especially in 2012 when Dortmund win the double, teams can take the title off Bayern one season.
Yeah, yeah.
But when it happens for a second successive season and Dortmund rubbed it in by winning 5-2 in the cup final, which... is, you know, the sort of,
it's unacceptable.
Yeah, it's
for
just,
Bayern.
It's just a bit. It's a bit like Dazed and Confused, where that guy O'Banion's going around giving licks to all the freshers.
Ben Affleck's fresh roll.
He's walking down. He's walking down the drive.
Yeah,
and the mum tells the kids to get in, and she pulls a gun on him.
And
goes, "Look, I see you on my property, I'm going to shoot you." Yeah. And then as he goes off and he's going, "I was just seeing these fine young men home," the kids sort of stick their heads around the door and he goes, "I saw that, you little shit. I'm going to get you. And that is Bayern after that cup final. And that provoked them into being their best ever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they just went on a tear from then. Of course, they already had this plan where they were going, in this trilogy that they talk about in Marty Perrineau's Pep Confidential of Van Gaal, Hankers, and then Guardiola. So they'd end up with this like sort of football utopia.
Yeah.
But the fact is, if clubs like, say, you got a Lyon to win the league or a Sporting to win the league, I mean, the reaction to that from their competitors is going to be absolutely massive. Yeah.
Well, no, you go ahead, Miguel.
You mentioned Leicester there, but if you look at that season as well, whatever about the kind of just wider ructions, that was also a season where basically all of the big clubs were in some form of flux. You know, City were going through the death throes of Manuel Pellegrini. Mm. Chelsea had the Mourinho season where they bottomed out to a degree never seen before. Liverpool sacked Brendan Rodgers, brought in Klopp. Manchester United were getting rid of Van Gaal and were pretty much done with him by Christmas that year. But what happens next then? That's, as Andy points out there, summer 2016 is when the Premier League became the league of the star manager. Poch went to a next level. City get Guardiola. Chelsea get Conte. Klopp gets his first full season in Liverpool, and United then go back to Mourinho. Whatever, but the wider debate there at that time. But yeah, you're completely right. It's just I suppose one of the interesting things here as well, like, because there is maybe a more inherent structural problem now in that a lot of these big clubs have to try and work their round over these squads that are almost stuck in place. And that, I think that's one reason why Madrid, Barca, and Juve in particular have looked just so vulnerable this season, because they're just kind of these lethargic operations.
It's difficult though, isn't it?
Super tankers,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. It's difficult for the bigger organisations, whether it be in football or in business or otherwise, to adapt to a changing situation.
But, John, I mean, actually, there'd be an interesting piece to be done on the fate of the 2014 German World Cup winning squad. Because everyone goes on about Mesut Ozil, but then Juventus have their own Ozil situation in Sami Khedira. Mm. And there are these situations that pop up all over these clubs now.
It's funny, actually. Khedira was on German telly with his younger brother, Rani, a couple of weeks ago on Das Aktuelle Sportstudio, which is like the equivalent of Match of the Day. And the two of them were in there, and normally, you know, you get warmly greeted by a studio audience, etc. There's no studio audience at the moment. Right. And also, Khedira was, it was almost like he was putting a note in the newsagent's window. He was going, well, look, I'm in great nick at the moment. I'd be happy to play anywhere. I'd love to play in the Premier League. I would be keen to play anywhere, and I would be ready from about January 1st.
Yeah, I'm not sure we're going to make that mistake again. But on a serious note, though, when we talk about the teams that are doing well, not in Europe, in these different leagues, Andy's mentioned Lyon in France, Sporting Lisboa in Portugal, and I can't remember, there was one more.
We had Fenerbahce, didn't we?
Yeah, Fenerbahce as well, in Turkey. Is it the case for all of these teams on the continent that their fans want them to win the league? You know, there's always this argument when these foreign coaches come over here that they don't understand the English fans' desire to win the league rather than the Champions League. You know, we don't care as much about the Champions League. At the end of the day, the domestic league is the paramount league for us, certainly in the top flight.
Well, I think there are two points for that. Firstly, is winning the Champions League as like your alternative a possibility for any of these teams? No. Even if Lyon did get to the semi-final and did very well to do so last season.
But even for the big teams, though, isn't the domestic league the a priori league competition to win?
Yeah, I think. But Real Madrid, for example, they're in a different place because their identity is so informed by the Champions League. You can get away with not winning the league if you win the Champions League.
Well, they just scrape through to the knockout stages.
I'm not saying they're winners yet.
Exactly.
I'm not
saying it's such a priority is the point I'm making.
I'm not saying they're winners yet. But
they're playing it.
I wanted to go back briefly to Miguel's point earlier about where the future leads us in terms of competitive balance after a season like this. Because they've had this task force in Germany, this DFB, FA task force at the moment, which is sort of trying to redistribute funds in an existing TV contract. And they've agreed to do that. They've kind of worked out this halfway house. And I think the chief exec of Leverkusen, for example, was saying, well, we voted to let a bit more of the money, almost get a little bit closer to the Premier League in terms of even distribution, not quite as far as that, but let a bit more of the money drip down to the smaller clubs and you know, the chief director of Leverkusen said, well, you know, this is, we've voted for what's not necessarily the best for Leverkusen, but the best for the league. But of course, everyone's not going to think like that. And yeah, one of the members of the task force, Cem Özdemir, who's also a politician for the Greens, he said, after speaking with Rummenigge about this and the way that he, I think he put it, violently reacted to the suggestion, I know that he's not interested in competitive balance. And how many of the biggest clubs are?
Yeah. Well, it's the fundamental contradiction of what professional sport is. Because competition or business competition is about killing the competition, and sport is about recreating competition at the start of every tournament. And it's one thing that's never solved. But just in relation to your point, though, about what they might want, I think one of the keys to this is that so many of these clubs, and some of them are really massive European clubs, like Sporting, like Lyon, like Fenerbahce. I mean, the reality is that because of the way European football has gone, these clubs have been basically starved of the trophies that would have been, you know, come along at periodic points there history for most of their history.
It's not just the trophies, it's the hope of the trophies,
the hope,
isn't it?
And that's what's been so depressing, the hope of the trophies, exactly. Mm. Because you can almost, you could live in a football world, say, where there was a title race. I think France is the classic example of this, really. When there's a title race every season, it doesn't matter to the same degree if the same club wins it every year if there is genuine peril that they won't. Because that's more kind of like, you can see the kind of the sporting competitiveness of it.
That's it. And the perception is actually more important than the reality. Because it feels like most years that there's no chance of anyone else winning it. I think we can forget that if you go back over the last decade, you've had Montpellier win it.
Yeah.
You've had Monaco winning it. Have you had anyone else winning it in Germany or in Italy over those years? No.
Yeah.
But it's about the feeling of jeopardy.
And you can see it every time when Dortmund play, like the classic example is actually was when the Bundesliga was the first league back in May, and it was suddenly everyone was up for it. There was all this hype about it.
And then
the second game, all this hope that, come on, Dortmund, we're going to have this amazing title race, and Bayern just killed them. It was so deflating.
It's the time, gentlemen, when you will recommend for us a game that we can keep an eye on this weekend. I'm going to go to you first, Andy, because I know that Miguel's got a cracker, so I don't want you to have to follow it, if you see what I mean.
Well, following on from our last section, I really want to believe, and Sunday night at the Parc des Princes, Paris Saint-Germain versus Lyon. Lyon, the informed team in Ligue 1 at the moment, playing with great freedom, really good football. The front three of Toko Ekambi, Memphis, Tino Caduere is really good to watch. Lucas Paquetá is proving a really useful signing. They always get absolutely hammered at the Parc des Princes in recent years. But, of course, Paris have had this bizarre situation where they've ended up having not just a Champions League game, but it being held over and having a day's less rest than they thought they might. Who knows?
Follow that.
For all the reasons we've been talking about, I'm going to go for the Madrid derby. Because, I mean, I know the Champions League is the one Simeone really wants, but it's already been so long now that Atletico winning the league would feel a revelation again. And this, I mean, they have the chance to, you know, really put the boot down on Madrid.
Can't follow that.
Delightful.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces
three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.